Okay, well, welcome back. I understand the last session was very exciting, and hopefully we'll continue that for the next 90 minutes. This is the panel on international politics. I'm Ken Shadlin. I'm also from LSE, Department of International Development, and I'm going to chair this panel. What I'm going to do is actually introduce all three of the speakers right now, and then I'm going to sit there so that you're not all staring at me and you can see the screen. And then I'm going to try to ask the speakers to kindly keep themselves to roughly 15 minutes or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion before we end the session. So, and we'll go in the order of the panel. The first speaker will be Christian Dowd from the OECD Development Center. Does everybody have these bios or no? Okay, so I'll tell you more about the speakers then, right? So, Christian has been at the OECD since 2008, previously was at the Inter-American Development Bank and the European Central Bank, research economist working on emerging market issues with a focus on Latin America, has a PhD and MA in economics from the University of Maryland in the U.S., and did his undergraduate studies in economics at the University of the Republic in Uruguay. Dr. Jose Fernandez Albertos is from the Spanish National Research Council, the Institute for Public Goods and Policies, has a PhD in political science, 3 chairs for political scientists, from Harvard, and an MA from the Center for Advanced Research in the Social Sciences of the Juan March Institute in Spain. He's been a research fellow at the Center for International Development at Harvard and the Center for Basic Research in Social Sciences, and he's also been at the Department of Political Studies at CIDE in Mexico City. Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I've known Stephanie for a long time, and I've been reading Stephanie Griffith-Jones' work since I was an undergraduate for years and years and years. Is one of the luminaries in the field of sort of international political economy and international finance. Spent much of her career at IDS in Sussex, and now is a research associate at Overseas Development Institute and the Financial Markets Program Director for the Institute for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. Stephanie is an expert on all sorts of things having to do with macroeconomic policy, debt, financial flows in emerging markets and in developed markets. And I very much look forward to all three of these presentations. And like I said, I will, I'll sit over there so I can see the screen, and I'll give you guys warning that about 10 or 12 minutes to give you a sense of where you are. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken, and thank you very much for the invitation. So I hope this will, I just talked a little bit about with Jose over here, and I hope the presentations are going to be sort of complementary between each other. So what I try to do is to talk a little bit about mainly sovereign debt crisis, yes? This doesn't mean that I think that it's only the only interests or the only important issues are on the sovereign side. Obviously, we have talked about it, and we heard today in the morning already a lot of the dynamics and the causes maybe of financial crisis are in excessive risk-taking and leveraging in the private sector, the banking system, etc. But I sort of want to look a little bit at the international financial architecture, so the political economy of the IMF, etc., and it's all around there, and think a little bit about the incentives for sovereigns, for creditors, and also for the issues of how we deal with policy coordination and institutions at an international level to solve these type of problems. Obviously, in terms of instruments and policies, there's always a clear distinction about how we should deal with liquidity issues and how we should deal with solvency issues. But I think Nuria Rubini has been one of the guys, I think he's been more eloquent about all these issues. Very easy to think about it in principles and economic terms, but in practice it's not so easy to distinguish them. And I think a lot of the debate and of the problems we face are actually have to do with our limited understanding of what are the roots and of financial crisis. So I talk a little bit about that, but I want to just emphasize some of the facts. I'm saying the facts like a loose term, but some of the empirical regularities, I think, on that highlight a little bit the potential inefficiencies of the status quo in terms of sovereign debt issues and problems in at international level. So one of the issues is that sovereign debt crises tend to bunch over time. So what we see here is, for example, a long panel from the paper in by Uwe Panica, Federico Sturzenegger, and Jeremy Settlemeyer. So if you look at over time, clearly what you see is that sovereign debt crises do not occur in one single country at a time, but they tend to occur at the same time in several countries many times. What does it mean? Of course, it could be that, and I think both of these things have always been present, but it could be that there are some international drivers to sovereign debt crisis, or it could also be that we have significant spillovers or contagion effects. Any of these two things point out that the international dimension of sovereign debt crisis is probably very relevant to think about and to think hard about. And I think many of our colleagues, and Stephanie, for example, has been also at the forefront of this, have thought a lot about this, because we tend to see that these things happen at the same time in a bunch of countries. So that's one of the things that is really important to keep in mind. The other thing, from a point of view of inefficiency, so if we want to look at really where could be the added value of policy coordination, of solutions, of institutions, has to do with restructuring. Yes, restructuring of when we come to an event of a default or of a sovereign restructuring, it often takes a lot of time. But it's also very important to keep in mind there are significant differences between each of the episodes. Yes, so for example, here I just have the frequencies, the years in default. Of the default that occurred in the 1980s, and the years of default, the country stayed in default. So before they gained access to markets, before they resolved the debt issues. And what's quite interesting is that first there's a lot of dispersion. So even we don't have the graphs here, but still some countries that defaulted in the 80s on the sovereign debt have basically not returned to private capital markets, for example. So there's also the tail is much longer over there. What's also interesting is that on average, in the 1990s, the time it took to resolve crisis actually, on average, was reduced. And it's quite interesting because banks, for example, or creditors would always argue that a lot of the institutional changes that took place in the early 90s were favoring sovereigns, and that this, and on the other side, that the coordination problems would become much more difficult once we moved from bank loans. A country had basically to negotiate with the group of banks, but it was facing basically one counterpart towards bonds, where obviously the issue of holdouts, etc., became much more important. And sort of a...
what's the y-axis?
It's the frequency. Just, yes? So it's 10%, I don't know, for example, if you look at 10% or around 12% of the crisis that occurred in the 1980s took less than 3 years out of the markets, yes? Sorry. So in terms of, I think that, and political scientists and economists have been starting to work together, and this is some work by Henrik Enderlein, for example, to look at sort of how coercive were these defaults, you know, and if you look at, this is a sort of a definition more based on process, not on the actual market losses, for example, for investors. But if you look at how coercive they were, this has been pretty stable over time, for example. So there's not a lot of evidence that creditors, for example, have been losing bargaining power or have been treated more coercively by debtors. And the same is also true when you look at, these are some of the recovery rates. So this is just, you know, if you would have 100, then this would be just say, when you restructured your debt, you're basically paying the same thing to the investor that you owed him before. So whatever the difference between 100 and the bars is the haircut, yeah? So what you see here is actually that there's a lot of variety between different episodes that happened in the 2000s in terms of how much did creditors lose in each of these episodes. You have basically some very friendly restructuring like the Dominican Republic or Uruguay in 2002 and others that have been in the news, for example, like Argentina, still unresolved and a pretty harsh default from the creditors' point of view, for example. But what I'm showing here basically is one thing that I'm not going to talk about, but it's really important to understand the dynamics of how countries get out and how they deal with the default, etc. I think it's domestic politics. Yes. So there has not been a lot of research actually on how countries get out and how they deal with default, etc. Until very recently, I would say there has been now 3 or 4 very interesting papers out there. They look at also the chances for re-election, etc. So a little bit at the political cost for politicians once they face defaults. So, but I think that it's important to keep in mind that there's a huge heterogeneity in how countries deal with defaults. And why am I saying this? I'm insisting because many of the solutions that we can think of is probably that we face different types of debtors also, you know. So if you think about countries and their polities, etc., they're very different. And so creditors cannot, it's probably very difficult to think about one-size-fits-all solutions in terms of the institutions also, because default occurs for different reasons and it's resolved in different ways, yes? So one last issue that has to do with this is that in general the theory would say you default in bad times, because it's sort of debt is a contract that is not state contingent on how things are going, and sort of that you default in bad times give you a little bit this insurance value of not repaying when you have actually trouble in paying. But actually, if you look at the evidence, and this is some work by Michael Toms from Stanford University and Mark Wright, they gathered a long time series of almost 180 defaults since 1820. And if you look at it, it's true. For example, here we have Argentina and Chile, that in the 80s and Argentina also in 2001, etc., they defaulted when they had. So the lines are the deviations from GDP, from GDP trend. Yes. So whenever it's below zero, it's saying that you're in a crisis. So they tended to default in moments when GDP was falling pretty harshly. But on the other hand, you also observe, and this in general in their data, defaults in good times, yes? And also you observe, for example, here you can see, for example, Argentina after World War I, moments of deep crises, and that countries did not default, for example. Yes? So the association between bad times and default, it's not so clear. And actually, this paper is actually really nice in showing this in the data. And again, I think this points again towards the domestic dimension, thinking a little bit more about why are some countries more tolerant to repay the debts and others are not. The other important issue, I think, is the changing role of the international financial institutions. So obviously the IMF, since its creation in Bretton Woods, has a key role. And I think a lot of the discussion that we've seen in the 1990s and the 2000s, even the ones that we see within the euro area, for example, regarding moral hazard, etc., all these things came up when discussing the international financial architecture and the role of the IMF. So in a certain sense, obviously, it should play the role of lender of last resort, provide liquidity, avoid costly self-fulfilling crises, etc. And in some cases also, when you have unsustainable debt, it could have, in principle, sort of a role in the restructuring, either by lending when the countries are doing the restructuring, and this has been something that has been debated a lot, the issue of lending under these conditions, or also even by providing information and incentives to creditors and borrowers. So in the 1980s, for example, the IMF opposed lending into arrears. So if a country was behind schedule in its payment, the IMF did not allow, you know, to roll over to have other banks step in and lend there. And this position was often seen, obviously, as too close to the creditors' interests. So the IMF in the 1990s, I wouldn't say that it changed clearly its behavior, but it started sort of experimenting in a very bad way, I would say, with doing things in another way. So this created a lot of uncertainty. So if you look at Russia, Brazil, Argentina, all these, the Asian crises, all these crises, nobody knew what the IMF was going to do. So in part, obviously, you could say, because there was no framework, no agreed framework of how they should deal with the crisis. But in a certain sense, the IMF actually made things worse in a couple of situations, also probably and lost a lot of its clout, I would say, a lot of its legitimacy, and I will come back to this in a second. The other issue that started to be debated also, and I think it's something that's also very much debated now in the euro area, is the issue of seniority. Yeah? So you'd think, obviously, that if you're the lender of last resort, you want to, you know, you want to make sure that you get always repaid so you can lend really at the risk-free rate. And that's a little bit the rationale of having seniority for the IMF. However, obviously a lot of the private creditors, for example, get nervous when they think that there's going to be a default, then the IMF is going to get repaid before. From the same pie, less is going to be there, so it means that the recovery rates are going to be lower. So what do you see? You have IMF lending and spreads go up, for example. Yeah. So there's a lot of debate on what should be the role here of the international financial institutions, and I think it's something that's still not resolved. So if you ask me, that's like the last point that I'd like to make has to do with the institutions for policy coordination and the multilateral solutions. So we know there has actually been a lot of change, and I would say advancement in terms of what has to do with international lender of last resort. So in the 1990s, the fund created something that's called the conditional credit lines. Yeah? So it was, you could have access to liquidity if you applied to a program and you fulfilled a couple of conditions in terms of your macro programs, etc., something like that. Guess what? No country wanted to take that. Yes, because you would apply for something like that actually in good times, but then you would signal that actually, oh, these guys are thinking that they might, you know, get into trouble or something like that. So it was really, one of the concerns was sort of giving a bad signal when you try to pre-qualify for this thing. And the fund has created now this flexible credit line, for example, that Turkey has, Mexico, etc., and Colombia, I think, also, and which is sort of not an automatic pre-qualification, but the conditionality is much lower. So it means that the stigma is not there anymore. And I think this is, for example, one thing that has helped. It's not the perfect solution, but it has helped to create instruments that are more useful in times of liquidity problems. Dealing with restructuring is clearly not solved yet. Ann Kruger, who was the number two of the IMF in 2001, came forward with something like a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism where that she proposed, but I think that is something that's still not resolved and where I talk a little bit now in my last 2 minutes about these issues. But the question here is obviously, why is it so difficult to reform or implement reforms in the international financial architecture? And I think there are three, and they're non-rival hypotheses, yes? One has to do only sort of an innovation externality argument. So, for example, this was the argument for the bonds that didn't have collective action clauses. Yeah? So these would be clauses that make it easier to restructure the conditions of a bond and not having everybody to... So you need a supermajority, but not everybody to agree on the restructuring of the bond. And here, for example, you could just say, you know, there's an issue of just... It's an externality, like any innovation externality. It doesn't exist, the instrument. Whoever creates it will not internalize the benefits of... the social benefits of creating it. And also, there's an issue of liquidity also. You cannot have just one small bond in the market. You need a market that's big enough so people can trade and can put reasonable prices on this, etc. So this could be an argument, and many things have been traded. I think, for example, the whole debate on the Argentinian debt, etc., most of them have actually these collective action clauses in there, etc. So... there has been some advancement from that point of view. I'm not so sure if we have been barking at the right tree, actually. I mean, but the other instruments have been created, GDP index bonds, etc. Sort of more exotic things, but they seem to have worked, but also not solved the whole thing. Yes, that could be also an incentive. I mean, there are a lot of incentive problems in terms of information. So, the issue could be that whatever we see, actually what we think is very inefficient, might be constrained efficient in the sense that given the information frictions and given the incentives that this creates to creditors, to debtors, etc., that this might be, we might not like it, but it might be the optimum from that point of view, and in this sub-optimum world, let's say. One of the issues, obviously, has been moral hazard, obviously, here. And I think it is still very much debated how much moral hazard, for example, is created by the existence of an international lender of last resort. You know, we don't discuss that, but we have discussed this in the euro area also regarding the ECB, for example, yes? Yeah, and all these issues are, I mean, this could be obviously one of the issues that still needs further work. The other issue, I think, has to do with incomplete information regarding the type of borrower you're facing. So this, for example, and to have a positive story, for example, and when Lula won the elections in 2003, I think, no? Two, exactly. So he immediately faced the sovereign debt crisis in the sense that Brazil got shut out of the markets, spreads went to the roof, etc., because everybody thought, oh, here, now we have the socialist government coming in and they will just not repay the debts, you know, because the debt service in Brazil is extremely high. The whole first 6 months of the Lula administration, I think, were just dedicated, not only, but in terms of macroeconomic issues, to signal the markets and show their determination of being a good debtor, if you want. So a lot of these type of things, if you think about democracies and also the issue of turnover of power, etc., have to do that there's really a lot of signaling going on and people might not want to subscribe, for example, for certain instruments or take certain things that are out there just not to show what type of borrower they are. And obviously the problem is obviously that the bad borrower wants always to mimic the good borrowers in certain moments of time. So reputation, more in general, is a concern also for the borrowing countries. All these problems create a trade-off in the sense that if this is important, it will reflect on the ex-ante cost of the insurance of these contracts, and this might undermine the ex-post benefits of having this insurance in the end. So the gains in terms of welfare might not be so high. So these are the two more economic explanations for it, but I think also political economy reasons for the international financial architecture are very important, especially if we think about IMF governance. And this is my last point. If you think about the Asian crisis, yes, I think a lot of what you see afterwards, the Asian economies moved into self-insurance. Yes, this has a lot to do with the reserve accumulation, etc. And why did they do so? They were that this can be risky and be costly, etc. But in a certain sense, they thought they could not rely on the IMF because they don't call the shots in the IMF. And I think this is in the very deep, a very deep level. And if you just look at nowadays the voting shares in the IMF. So this was before the reform, yes. Then we had the reform, and China went, for example, from less than 3% to doubling its quota and its voting shares, etc. But still, if you compare it, obviously the quota is a very complicated formula to get sort of a political equilibrium out. But if you just look at, I don't know, here we have one of the things that you could look at is GDP per capita, and this is the share that these countries have nowadays, and this is work that have done our colleagues in the economics department. And in 2030, where it would be, yes, China would be almost a third of the world economy, roughly, yes? And this just is showing that obviously in terms of governance, many of these countries feel that they're underrepresented still, yeah? It's very difficult also because the small ones, for example, small Europeans are probably the ones that are overrepresented, but also in the new quotas, the small emerging and developing countries have lost, for example, yeah? So many, many players, veto players, and opposing reforms here. And I think this is one of the issues that also has to do with, if you look at the G20, for example, the whole discussion on this is not moving forward. And I think it is part of these issues that are behind them. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, thanks very much for giving me an opportunity to present some of the thing that I'm working here. Thank you for being here at this time of the day. What I'm going to present is very, I don't know if it's going to be complementary to the previous paper. It's going to be definitely not a substitute, because it's going to be very different in terms of the thing that I will be talking. I will be talking about what are the implications of the current economic crisis for the possible emergence of some sort of supranational governance at the EU level, and what are the challenges and the problems that the emergence of an eventual new way of supranational governance in Europe might have. So here's just an overview about what, in the good times, what the EMU was supposed to achieve. The EMU was set to achieve a further integration of European economies. It was going to be the driver of the hard-needed reforms that some countries in the European periphery needed. And it would drive, eventually, convergence in economic fundamentals. That was the big, like, counter-argument to the asymmetrical, to the threat of asymmetric crisis that the people at the other side of the Atlantic were making to for the EMU area to not being an optimal currency area. So the argument in Europe was that eventually, by this further economic integration, we would have this convergence in economic circumstances. And more importantly, from a political point of view, there would be eventually some policy convergence some convergence in the policy preferences that that emerge from EMU countries. In reality, we had the total opposite of all these three things. We had more diverse political economies. Some EMU countries became more export-oriented, some became more domestic-oriented as a result of the EMU itself. We had some dysfunctional policies that were supposedly being forced to be restructured, somehow locked in into the political systems. So we have, I'll have some examples here. We had labor market policies, rigid labor market policies locked in Spain, for instance, as a result partly of the bubble that we experience as a result of our membership in the EMU, you can argue. And we had greater asymmetries in inter-country policy conflict. This idea that our preferences towards the common policies that would emerge from Europe would be the same, we had the total opposite. We had now some countries demanding Eurobonds, some countries demanding the total opposite, some countries demanding more active monetary policies, and some countries demanding the total opposite. So these are things that are not directly related to the crisis itself. These things happened in the good years. These were and any some sort of new political infrastructure that we built as a result of the crisis, we should take into account that these things are gonna happen if we don't address them in the good years. So even if we eventually come out of the crisis, we still have to address these problems. This is just one example of how EMU was related to divergence. This is just the export share as a percentage of GDP for Spain and Germany. Prior to the beginning of the entrance of the third phase of the EMU, Spain and Germany were becoming more internationalized economies in pretty much the same way, at the same rhythm. But once EMU entered into effect, Germany became much more competitive, and we all know that story. Spain became export. It's not that we ended up. We stopped exporting things. But it's that our economy started growing in things that were not exports. So exports become a much smaller fraction of the total economy. And this is important not only in economic terms but also in political terms. So the political leverage of the exporting sector in Spain got diminished as a result of this phenomenon. This is just one illustration of this problem of bad economic policies getting locked in. We all know this story about fiscal. One illustration, we know that the stories of fiscal deficits, as we saw this morning, are different in each country. But we have the situation in Spain. We didn't overspend in the good years. We were spending about a bit less than 10%. Less than the EMU average in terms of public spending as a percentage of GDP. We increased that share much more during the years of the crisis because the crisis hit us hardest, and unemployment particularly took it hard. And we also had one of the biggest stimulus packages in the EMU area. But what really differed us in terms of fiscal sustainability is the state revenues, right? So whereas the EMU pretty much remained constant in terms of public revenues as a surge of GDP, we observed this dramatic fall in state revenues as a result of the crisis. And this is just the result of a fiscal system that was based that over-relied on bubble-related transactions, to put it that way, right? So once the bubble ended, the state ended up having these resources. And we didn't have a fiscal reform during the EMU, because in these years, during the boom years, we are looking at the deficit as a percentage of GDP ratio, and we even had surpluses in good years, right? So we weren't looking at we were doing just fine, although the bad policies were already there, right? So we have this now the situation now in the European periphery is these two big problems: lack of competitiveness we have, and fiscal deficits, and we already know that these are very difficult to solve in a fixed exchange rate regime. I always remember we were talking about Andrés Velasco before. Andrés Velasco, I heard him in a conference saying that solving a competitiveness problem without a nominal exchange rate devaluation, it's very, 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 very difficult. It might be even impossible, right? So this is one of the situations we are in now. We know that Euro membership makes these things very difficult to solve directly, because we can't restore competitiveness by devaluing our currency, and we cannot inflate our economy to lower the burden of our debt. But also, and that's the thing that I would emphasize, it makes indirectly makes the alternatives to this devaluation and debt relief problems more politically controversial, right? Partly because of the things that I said before, because the smaller international sector makes internal devaluation less attractive politically. That's one of the problems of regaining competitiveness by lowering salaries. And in an exporting country, the political problems that this creates is much lower than in a domestic oriented economy. That's the problem that we have now in Spain, for instance. And something that I think is not often said. I think that income inequality that was not created, but definitely not solved during the bubble years, makes fiscal adjustment politically more complicated. And I think it's a very easy argument to make that the more economically diverse, heterogeneous, and unequal a society it is, the more difficult it is to come up with common fiscal adjustments that are perceived as legitimate and just and fair by a larger part of the population, and that's part of the problem. We have here just from the OECD income inequality database the ratio of the first one, the incomes of the first quantile towards the lowest quantile. We know that the bubble countries had higher income inequality rates than the rest of the EU, and this actually you can argue that they increased during the bubble years. And in some cases are increasing now much during the crisis. This country that increases dramatically income inequality in the last year is actually Spain, according to this indicator. So the argument I want to make is that we already knew that monetary policy was historically in this key to address the problems of debt and competitiveness. But we forgot that monetary policy was also a very apt tool to manage the was a very useful tool from a political standpoint, because it enabled governments to address some distributional conflicts that are extremely difficult to address in a piecemeal fashion, right? And we don't have the alternative. So I think one obvious solution is that monetary policy will become, and is becoming actually in these days, more politicized, and that's something that we forgot as part of that had to be forgotten in some way as part of the European project. But that's something that's it's unavoidable to occur. So we have this problem that we have We already know that we have a monetary regime that is currently unsustainable, and we have different paths to reform it. And I would like, in this last part of the presentation, I would like to mention what are the three main different scenarios that we already know what they are, but I would like to emphasize what the political sustainability of each of them are. So the first alternative is obviously, well, let's move democratic policymaking towards the EU level. That seems sort of the most obvious solution. But we are observing very, very slow movement in this realm. And actually, I would argue that the reforms that we are seeing, like the proposal of having an elected president of the European Commission, or this something of that sort, are being created in a much slower speed than actually the increasing renationalization of the economic policy debate in each of the countries. So that is a bad sign. And actually, we all know that the EU as it exists actually was designed. You can argue that it was designed to deal with policies that had limited distributional consequences, and that it is ill-fitted to address these huge distributional demands that the current situation requires. We are all the proposals that come from Europe these days are actually rule-based solutions, right? Like these are the six pack, the fiscal compact, the proposal of having a super minister that has to sign every fiscal decision by any member state, EMU member state. So these are rules-based solutions that don't solve the problem that the populations have some say in how their economic policy making is conducted, and that's problematic. And the most important problem is that this sort of delegation towards supranational institution, we all know that it's not very popular everywhere, right? So I have just here one graph showing the difference in net trust towards the EU, that is the percentage of the population in each country that trusts the EU minus the percentage of the population that distrusts the EU, and taking the difference between 2011 and 2001 at the beginning of the Euro period, right? And we have on the left-hand side of the graph, we have all EMU member countries, for which all of them except for Finland, actually trust in the EU has declined sharply. And in some countries, like in Spain, for instance, there's a 50% difference in the difference between people that trusted the EU minus people that distrusted the EU in 2001 and 2011, right? And actually, paradoxically, the countries that avoided the euro are the countries that have become more pro-European, right, over time. So if the euro was like this symbolic step to build more Europeans, it looks like the data doesn't confirm this hypothesis, right? So So this is just to say that it is going to be, if there is a movement of European of democratic policy making towards Europe, it will be somehow against the will or not particularly pushed by the European citizens, right? The second alternative we already know is, okay, if we need to politicize monetary policy, if monetary policy was necessary to address these distributional conflicts that now we have to address, let's get monetary policy back. Let's break up the euro. We know that this is extremely costly and uncertain, and this fear of what will happen if we leave the euro is probably what prevents European governments to do things that would put the euro into risk, right? And that's why we are observing these continuous small measures that keeps us there without destroying the monetary union. Then I would like to also say that we might, in all this discussion, we might underestimate the capacity of European societies to tolerate austerity. I don't know. I was very scared by the story that in the previous panel, the stories that they were told about Greece, which probably is the most extreme case. But I come from a country where you hear austerity stories everywhere in the news and in the debates in the street and demonstrations and strikes, and yet you observe a silent majority, as the government used to likes this expression, that still is very afraid of any big reforms that might put the euro into risk or are belonging to the euro into risk, right? And there are several reasons. I think we should try to also to study more this the asymmetric. What's the political economy of support for austerity, of support for euro membership, even in the face of these drastic reforms and hardships, right? And I think we have to understand that the austerity doesn't have effect, doesn't have the same economic effects on all groups of society, that it has asymmetric effects on austerity. You know, for instance, in countries with big immigrant populations, immigrants are much more hard hit than the natives. So that acts as a political cushion for austerity. We know, for instance, that the more politically mobilized voters, like pensioners in Spain, get somehow protected for with austerity measures, whereas the young and the outsiders in the labor market, for instance, that don't even get unemployment subsidies when they get fired, they get all the pain, right? So probably societies are much more resilient to many of these austerity measures up until now. We don't know how much this will end. Also, in political societies, there's other conflicts that actually act not as cushions, but as make these austerity measures more complicated to interpret and to have political consequences, right? We have just an election in Catalonia last Sunday, in which the current the incumbent government won the election, which is something that's very weird to happen in Europe these days. And that's probably happening because one of the reasons you could argue is that even if they imposed hard measures on austerity, one of the things that they were saying is that these measures on austerity had to do with the bad ways in which public finances worked in Spain and how Catalonia is so badly treated for the rest of Spain, etc. You have in other countries immigration, other problems that might sort of make the salience of how hard the austerity measures are less politically important. And then I think one important aspect is also there's this in all these countries there is a domestic narrative of the crisis that I think is very important. That if you ask who is responsible for the crisis, I think this is the case for I studied the case of Spain, but I think this is the case also in Greece, and I would say in Portugal, even in Ireland. The main culprit of the crisis is domestic politicians, the domestic banks, if you will, the domestic political system that was rotten. There is no narrative at the public opinion level that says that blames the euro or the EMU system or the lack of monetary policy at the national level as the responsible for these trends, right? So I don't know if I don't have time, right, to go into. I'll just say that. Let me just say that we have in a survey experiment that we ran with a couple of colleagues, and it's coming out now in International Studies Quarterly. We have these experiments in which we tell this very little line about who is responsible about the crisis. According to our report, a series of international factors related to globalization have played a major role in the development of the economic crisis. We tell to some people this story, and some other people will tell the story about regulations in the Spanish labor market have played a major role. This very simple sentence. And this actually had this dramatic effect in making, for instance, supporters of the government more likely to blame other European governments as they just by receiving this treatment. And some important effects, that the things that I want to emphasize, those that are not partisans, that are not attached to either the PP or the PSOE, the Conservative or the Socialist Party, become more anti-globalization as they hear this story about the crisis being a global story rather than a domestic story. So we really don't know what the eventual political consequences of these things would be. And the third alternative, which I think is probably the most likely one, is this continuous, which is the one that we observe, is increased delegation of policy making to either experts or rules. We know that this solution itself has many problems. One is that we know one of the lessons from this crisis is that flexibility on the hands of monetary policymakers is needed. They have to be innovative. They have to do things that they weren't doing before. So having like strict mandates, it's problematic. There is this fiction of policy separability. So in many policy documents, you hear the story about
this proposal of let's delegate, for instance, fiscal rules to some independent agency, monetary policy to this independent central bank, and let domestic politicians to decide only on the allocation of spending and incomes. But this thing, this idea is much more complicated, and in real terms you observe that once you have monetary policy autonomy as the European Central Bank, it's very easy to start intervening in fiscal policy decisions and telling governments what fiscal policy decisions they have to take in case you want some kind of monetary response. Distributional conflicts won't go away, and if we have distributional conflicts, probably we might need more democracy to address these distributional conflicts in a way that is politically sustainable. And this last idea is that in a very long crisis, the fact that policies lack democratic support might actually threaten its very political policy credibility. Like in a very short term, to adopt policies that are unpopular might actually signal your commitment to a particular policy or a particular route of action. But over the long term, adopting policies that are continually unpopular and subjective to threats from the political sphere, from elections, etc., might be perceived by markets and incredible. That's not credible. And I think that's part of the problem that we are observing these days. So on that note, I will stop there. Thank you.
So I want to thank very much the organizers of this conference, which is so well organized and also has been so extremely interesting. I want to speak about two separate parts. One, I want to ask first what are the lessons from Latin American and other previous crises for Europe. And secondly, I want to, as I've been mentioning in my questions, try and show that there is an alternative for Europe, that all this austerity is not necessary, and that it's in fact bad arithmetic, bad economics, and ignores the lessons of history. So firstly, and very briefly, about the lessons from Latin American and other crises, I think the first lesson is quite obvious, but it keeps needing to be repeated, is that financial liberalization without proper regulation leads inevitably to crisis. As Shakespeare says, like the night follows day. You know, we saw it in the 1930s, we saw it in Latin America in the 70s and 80s, we saw it in East Asia, and we now saw it in the crisis that started in the United States and then spilled over to Europe with the subprime crisis. So I think a very interesting question, since we have so many political scientists in the room, is why does this keep happening again? Why do we allow finance to be liberalized, to do all this damage to the real economy, and why don't we learn the lessons? And also there's now the major challenge about whether finance will be properly regulated, and there's a whole big debate about that. And one thing that I find particularly irritating is that finance is very powerful in the good times because everything's going well, so why would you want to regulate? You know, the parties at its best, and only people like the former governor of the Fed many years ago said you have to take away the punch bowl when the party's at its best. Most people don't have the political courage to do that. But the even more annoying thing is that when there is a crisis, when finance has been seen to have been causing so much damage, it is also very powerful. Because it says, if you regulate us, then we won't be able to lend into the recovery. And you need desperately a recovery. Of course, they're not lending anyway. But they use that as an excuse, in a way, and the politicians and the regulators are in a very difficult bind about whether they do regulate properly to avoid the next crisis, or they are liberal and facilitate the recovery, and then this will lead to another crisis. So I think there's a deep question there about why finance is so powerful. And I will give just a few hypotheses, which I think may have some relevance, but some of you may have much clearer answers. I think one of the sort of in the short term, and particularly in the United States, of course, finance has become extremely large. And therefore, for example, 40% of corporate profits in the United States is actually in the financial sector, which, as Stiglitz likes to say, shows an inefficiency, because if you're an efficient financial sector would intermediate at low cost and do it well, and they don't do anything. But the fact that they're so powerful and that they play a big role, particularly clear in the United States, but also in other countries, in financing, for example, political campaigns, gives them a lot of power. And then, because there's so much, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, such a large part of the economy and of the profits and the high-paid individuals are in the financial sector, there's a sort of macroeconomic capture, which you hear very much in the United Kingdom, which says, oh, we can't really do things to lower the size of the financial sector because we depend on them for our tax revenues, forgetting how much it costs to bail them out. So these are some elements, but I don't think it's the full story. And I think, in fact, in developing countries, particularly actually in poorer countries, there is a chance to get this right, to not let the genie out of the bottle, and to have smaller, less complex financial sectors that do what they're supposed to do, which is serve the real economy, rather than make profits for themselves. I'm actually leading a program on this in the African low-income countries. And if any of you are interested, I would love to talk to you, because we're going to be commissioning or calling for bids on that. Because I think there is an opportunity. And today, of course, in developing countries, we haven't had a financial crisis. In this, it's not maybe a global crisis, as people like to call it here. It's a North Atlantic crisis, as the Indian economists call it. And the developing countries have actually learned, not so much because I think they're more clever, but because they have had so many crises in the past. They have learned the costs of deregulation, and so therefore they have been more careful. And I think the only risk in developing countries is that they will become complacent and will say, well, we don't really need to worry because our financial sector is so great. We withstood the global crisis, and then they will start doing silly things and liberalize derivatives without controlling them and allowing credit booms and so on. So I think this is an important lesson which deals more with a little bit more with the future. Now, as regards the present and the near term, the management of the crisis, I think there's also a key lesson to emerge from the management of the Latin American debt crisis and the East Asian, but particularly Latin American, is that drastic austerity does not work. It will just lead to major recession, which will make the debt crisis worse for quite a long period and lead to, as it did in Latin America, to a lost decade for development. And now we're talking about a lost decade in Europe. So Krugman and Stiglitz talk about a collective suicide pact, which is that European countries, through these rules that the previous speaker mentioned, have agreed to impose austerity, both surplus and deficit countries, at the same time. Now, Europe, even though it does trade quite a bit, say, Germany with China, but also in a major way, including the UK, although they forget that they are in Europe, trade in a major way with each other. So if they're all imposing austerity measures at the same time, there will be cuts in growth, there will be cuts also and in employment, not only because of their own austerity, but also because of the austerity of the countries with which they trade. And therefore, the impact, the cumulative impact, will be higher. And this is something which is actually quite obvious, but it has been broadly ignored, except in a few more Keynesian models. So I just want to emphasize that this, at a macro level, I think this the management that has been done, and it's a little bit sometimes diffuse in terms of does it have to be linked to the euro or not? Should you be in or out of the euro? I think that is an important discussion, and should you strengthen European institutions? And I'm personally very pro-European. But I think you can only be pro-European if Europe delivers, if Europe delivers growth and jobs. Because if it doesn't, it's not offering anything. You know, eternal austerity cannot be attractive to the kids who are protesting on the streets because they don't have a job, they don't have a future. So it is a policy which is bad arithmetic, because if you're trying to lower debt to GDP and you take measures which may perhaps lower debt, it's not clear, but which will certainly lower GDP, your debt to GDP ratios will not fall. And we see that dramatically in the case of Greece. It's bad economics for the reasons that I explained, and it ignores the lessons of history, because we've seen that in the 1930s this didn't work, that in Latin America it didn't work. So I think this is bad economics, and it's bad politics. Now, is this inevitable? Is there no alternative? And I feel that there's a little bit throughout the discussions here, but more if you go to a conference in Brussels, there's a tremendous insecurity. Like, you know, we Europeans, we Greeks have done everything wrong. And that always happens in crisis. I remember talking to my Argentinian friends in the middle of the last big Argentinian crisis. Everybody was terribly depressed. Everybody was terribly insecure, because that's what crises do to you. But then you have to have a sort of alternative vision. And I think that there is an alternative which would consist of three elements. One is a European response. Pan-European measures. Secondly, countries without market access, like Greece in particular, and then countries with market access, the UK case. And so I want to talk a little bit about pan-European measures. So we have European institutions, like the structural funds, which is 1 trillion euros for the next 6 or 8 years. We have the European Investment Bank, which in the first phase of the crisis went up to 70 billion euros of lending. And there are clear ideas, in theory already endorsed by the leaders, of doubling capital of EIB and creating project bonds. So, for example, we did this proposal with the former vice president of the EIB, which would mean increasing EIB lending and use of the budget, I don't have time to go into the details, by about 60 billion annually for the next 3 years. And we have estimated, and this is in a nicer graph, so you can see the 60 billion euros, which is roughly, not quite, what the Marshall Plan was, which helped rebuild Germany and other European countries. And we have estimated what effects this would have. Approximately, it could create over 1 million jobs, which is not a lot in the sense that there's about 18 million or more unemployed in Europe, but it's quite significant, and it could add 0.5% of growth to Europe. Again, not enough, but it's quite positive. Now, these measures are sort of talked about, hardly reflected in the press, which is much more interested in the last gossip about Spain or Greece or the last riot, or rather than about a European vision, and which the politicians have not articulated. But this is a possible avenue with existing institutions, with existing budgets, if they are approved. But as you see, the discussion is more about how to cut the budget, rather than how to use it in a small way. You know, EU budget, we're talking about 20, 30 billion euros, which is nothing if you think how much money has been thrown at rescuing the banks, to use a little bit for viable investments to help restructure Europe and to help making more viable economies to make Europe more competitive would not be a lot. So that's one area where I think there's a lot of potential if the vision is there. François Hollande, in particular, in his initial phase, seemed to be a very strong supporter of this, but it's not clear why it's not moving further. But this is not enough. There could be alternative policies at a national level. And I think we need to distinguish between countries with limited market access, which need to have their debt servicing costs lower. And I think it's quite encouraging that this week there have been some efforts at debt reduction and debt service reduction for Greece. And of course, the actions of the ECB, the potential, the Draghi announcement that he would intervene up to 3 years debt, has significantly lowered debt servicing costs and spreads for countries like Italy and Spain, which is positive. But the problem with that, both in the Greek case and the Italian and Spanish, is that it's always linked to this tough conditionality of austerity. So the ECB would give you money, or would, sorry, would buy your government debt if you followed particularly tough austerity measures, which these countries are following anyway. Greece will get this reduction of debt, provided, or debt servicing, provided it pursues these absurdly tough austerity measures. GDP has already fallen in Greece by 20%. In no financial crisis before, ever in the world, has GDP fallen as much. I think the highest have been countries like Chile and Argentina, falling 14-15%. I mean, 20% is just unacceptable. Public employees' salaries have fallen 30%. I mean, it is amazing that people actually tolerate this. So that is not actually going to be a remedy. I mean, it's good to have debt service reduction because it opens potential for fiscal space, but not if you then constrain it to such a large extent. I think very important is the idea of having countries which have clear fiscal space. And of course, the clearest example is Germany. Germany is also doing today budget consolidation. It's also trying to lower the level of debt to GDP. Even though, you know, investors are fighting like crazy to buy German bonds, even though the cost of their borrowing is the lowest historically. And even though their economy is doing so well, in the sense of having a very large trade surplus, it is not doing so well in terms of growth, because it's actually slowing down a lot because of the impact of the rest of the Eurozone. So an important question, you know, which Keynes would have asked, you know, where is the adjustment in the surplus countries? Why is Germany not slowing down its fiscal consolidation or even expanding some of its spending? Or even having increased taxes on the rich, which are then used for more investment, say, in infrastructure. Because that, as the IMF has recently discovered, actually has a positive multiplier. And of course, not just decreasing the pace of fiscal consolidation, but also increasing wages. Because we hear so much about how great it is that Germany has become more competitive, which is, of course, very good, but it's not just because they lowered wages, it's also because they are capable of increasing productivity so much. But if Germany increased its wages, it would increase aggregate demand for the Greeks and the Spanish and all these other countries, who would then have to adjust less downwards. Yeah. So that is actually discussed very little, even though wages in Germany are very high, have actually fallen quite a lot. And I would like to finish with the case of the UK, where there have been a number of very good papers, which recently, particularly produced in the National Institute, which show that even if you accept that you have to do the fiscal consolidation in the UK, and some very Keynesian economists would say you don't even have to do fiscal, but assuming you have to do the fiscal consolidation in the UK, do it later. And do it slower. And if you did that, according to these estimates from this paper by Badaria and others at the National Institute, a recent paper, if you just did it 3 years later, and assuming that by then there will be a recovery, some recovery in the UK and in Europe, you would have 16% higher GDP by 2021 than if you do the adjustment now. Why? Because you're doing it at a time when the UK economy is in a recession, when the banking system is not lending, if anything, it's deleveraging, And therefore, if you are having fiscal consolidation at that period, the multiplier of that fiscal consolidation is much higher than if you did it in good times, when monetary policy is working, when credit policy is working, and when you don't have so much unemployment and people are not so afraid to borrow and to spend, and companies are not so afraid to borrow and to invest. So if you just postpone the adjustment and give breathing space so that the economy starts recovering, you can actually have a very positive impact on growth. And I would like to finish with a similar outcome from another model, which looks at this in European terms. And in European terms, if you postpone fiscal consolidation according to this calculation, you could have higher GDP by 4% in the EU than if you do not do it. So therefore, you know, why are we following these policies which have such negative outcomes, which are putting pressure politically and economically on ordinary people, which are threatening the future of the euro, and which are avoidable? I think the key issue is that there is an alternative. I think it's a bit like in the time of Mrs. Thatcher, those of you who remember, when there was this idea, TINA, there is no alternative. And people, both in the debtor and the surplus countries, keep repeating that this is the path that has to be followed. And it has been, as the previous speaker said, embedded in rules, which make the situation worse. But I think the case is quite clear that there are alternatives, and that what is needed are leaders with vision which would be able to implement this, to learn from the lessons of history, and to follow a good economic policy. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, I want to thank all three of the speakers for their very interesting presentations and keeping to time as well. So we have roughly 15 minutes. So why don't we take some questions from the floor and have a discussion? Lawrence.
That was a very interesting and challenging thing you put forward, Stephanie. It did seem to me the last part is the crucial bit, and it came rather quickly with 16% more UK GDP. Sounds easy, sounds nice. And then the next model only gave us 4% more EU GDP. And that seemed to me to suggest that there's a certain amount of uncertainty around these models. They may depend rather on the assumptions that you're making. Because in some ways you'd expect that postponing, given the state of Europe, you'd expect that postponing austerity, you know, in Spain and so on, would give you a bigger bag for your buck than the UK, where actually the austerity hasn't really kicked in yet very much, has it? We're still running an 8% or 9% fiscal deficit. So I'm very attracted. I want to believe there's an alternative. I think you did it too briefly, and the obvious counter-argument would be, oh, yes, you know, depending on the assumptions you feed into a model, you can get that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think that's a good comment. I must say, I just saw this last article, so I haven't studied it in depth, but I think that the effects are much more short-term, whereas for the UK, it's over 10 years. So there's a longer, I mean, this is obviously, it depends, of course, how you construct the model. This is a very changing model, which makes institute. But I think that also the kind of arguments that they give about austerities, about the fact that the credit markets are not functioning, are very powerful. The fact that monetary policy can't really support very much, because interest rates are already so low. So we need to do something on the fiscal side. And so therefore, I think the case is very strong in terms of that if you just lower the pace of fiscal consolidation, you could also argue that that is more risky, you could say, you know, the UK still has very low borrowing costs, although, you know, I can question whether the markets are wise, because our debt levels are quite high, whether the UK, in fact, could just do less fiscal consolidation. But even if you take this rather conservative line, then you come out with this better outlook. But I think it's also equally important, which I also said a bit quickly, that Germany, which has actually really no problem at all, I mean, its debt levels are quite high. I think nobody is going to question Germany, unless there's a major collapse in the rest of the euro. But if Germany were to actually take a more expansionary policy, both in terms of income of people, wages, and on the fiscal side, you know, it would have, it's the biggest economy in Europe, so it could have a very expansionary effect on the rest of the European economy. And there, I think the main constraint, as it is over here, are kind of perceptions, basically. You know, if the kind of economists, what they think, and by because I think also if the politicians were to do this and explain to the markets the rationale, I think the markets would actually follow. It's because the markets and the politicians are trapped, I think, in the sense mutual reinforcing emphasis on austerity. But in fact, markets do like growth, because, for example, when Hollande was elected, I think the spreads actually fell in France, because he had promised greater emphasis on growth. So even though the markets criticize countries for having very high debt to GDP ratio, they also criticize countries for not growth. So you're going to be damned if you do, and you're going to be damned if you don't. You should at least follow the right policy and not blame being so cautious on trying to please the market.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I wasn't going to follow up on this particular question, but I think I am going to, having heard what I just heard. I actually started my career at the National Institute, and I did lots of modelling. And what you just said is right. You know, it all depends on the assumptions in these models, quite frankly. So I mean, one of the important things here would be, well, what are you assuming is going to happen to interest rates when you do these things, and it's all to do with confidence and so on. You can model it, you can make some assumptions. So I think it's a little bit unclear. I don't know this particular paper myself, so I'm not going to comment on it, but I will just mention that I'm from the OECD, and the OECD has been castigated by Krugman for being rather hard line. I mean, we've had our latest economic outlook on Tuesday of this week, and there we've said you shouldn't, in conditions where the downturn's getting worse, you should not try to be hitting nominal targets sort of set in stone. You should let the automatic stabilizers work at least. That's, of course, not as far as you may want to go, or the Stephanie Griffith-Jones may want to go, but I mean it is dealing in part with this issue of not driving down the economy through continuous consolidation. I mean, where I wanted to come in actually was on Jose's presentation on a different sort of governance in Europe. I mean, one thing I would have mentioned in the earlier session on the European discussion was that you know, if you want to have monetary union, all economists will tell you need to have fiscal union of some sort. I mean, not just let the fiscal policies sort of drift from country to country. You've got to have some burden sharing and so on. It just doesn't work. I mean, somebody mentioned the size of the federal government share of GDP and compared it with the 1% that the Commission budget is, and that's really central. You've got to be able to have some redistribution if you're going to have monetary union, because you can't have all of the adjustment being just on one side. And of course, there wasn't fiscal union when monetary union started up, so of course it was wonderful for a number of years for countries who suddenly had extremely low interest rates, had booming conditions, had housing markets booming as in Spain and so on. Greece did extremely well and was a poster child of growth for quite a few years, as you know. And it was wonderful, and they had the Olympics and so on and so forth, and everything seemed to be fine. But of course, if you let things get out of control, then you end in tears in that sort of way. But I mean, the monetary union does, I mean, this has been pointed out right from the start, it has, you know, certain bits lacking. Just one final comment, and that is Ireland got mentioned, and it was mentioned as being part of a chain. Well, you know, if Greece goes out, then there'll be Portugal and so on and so forth. I mean, Ireland has been growing since 2011. Ireland has got growth back. I mean, Ireland is, I would say, it's still got a problem because it's got all this debt that came from the banking side. But Ireland has managed to deal. And it's a different economy than some of the southern European ones, I would admit that. And, US multinationals are in there. But it does have growth. It's been growing since 2011. It's got strong exports. It's growing its way out of the problems. And it's partly because it dealt with the banking issues sort of pretty seriously up front, even though it cost a lot to the budget, and some people actually said they should have walked away from the banking problems and let people suffer the losses, but they didn't do that. It's on the government budget, and they've got high debt.
Thank you. Somebody else have a hand? Yes.
To the euro exchange rate, I mean, nobody really talks about that, and I guess it's probably because I guess it's the same thing. What is good for some countries is not good for another within the euro. But that will be probably a one way to get out. No, if the euro will I don't know trade at 1.15 or something, and then. I guess it will facilitate a lot of exports, even Germany itself, to really reinstate growth within the European Union. And I'm just curious because nobody really talks about that, and I guess it's because the U.S. is in such a tough condition that there is not much devaluation either way. I'm just curious to see if you have any views on this.
Should you like to speak to that?
Yeah, maybe. I think this issue is actually much more complicated. It's not only U.S. And Europe. Yes, I think the key players here probably are the big emerging markets. Yes, if you think about that, and they have their reasons. But I think part of the automatic adjustment that you would see is a lot of appreciation, China has been appreciating quite a lot, and you see that the trade balance has been closing from the surplus to something much more in line with. But I think nobody's complaining right now that China is a currency manipulator, for example, anymore. And I think I think if you look around the world, it's not only the bilateral exchange rate between the EU and the US, because I think big emerging markets are not doing the adjustment. I mean, this is the whole issue of the currency wars, etc. And I think there are a lot of fears already to let the currencies appreciate, which would take part of the... Because there you would see clear demand in a certain sense, because... Also, it's not clear whether the export demand comes from a competitive devaluation, let's say, of the euro area. If you think about the U.S. is recovering steadily, etc., but it's also not growing at a spectacular rate. It will absorb or create this export demand. I think it's a more global issue and probably much more complicated than just euro-U.S. dollar. That's, I mean, nobody's talking about that in the euro area because I think also we have decided that we have a floating exchange rate, so that's sort of obviously also something that has to do with the policy stance.
Just something very brief. I totally agree with the previous speaker, but I think also an interesting point to make is that that Germany, of course, is benefiting from the fact that it is part of the euro area. That's sometimes forgotten, because by being linked to weaker economies, their currency is weaker than it would have otherwise been. I mean, those that advocate that Germany should leave the euro, one of the issues is that then either the German euro or the Deutschmark or whatever would become very strong, and then Germany would be much less competitive. And because a lot of their growth has been based on on actually having a relatively weak euro that has actually benefited. So that's, you know, often forgotten, because when they complain, they are other countries, but they've also benefited from that in a different way. It's quite a significant.
Thanks. I was given strict instructions as a chair that I wasn't to take any more questions after 1655, but I wasn't told that I wasn't allowed to ask my own question. So I'll do that. And I have a question actually for Christian. And you put up one slide in which you showed that sort of the period of being excluded from private capital markets post-default has gone down. And you put up another slide sort of on comparative haircuts, basically. And my sort of eyeball versioning of that slide was that the countries that imposed the larger haircuts also had the larger post-default recovery. And so if that interpretation is right, and if the first slide, so if the first slide says the cost of default are lower than they ever were, and if the second, my interpretation of the second slide says is that the bigger you, when you, if you default, the bigger you restructure, the better you do, then isn't the sort of the answer for putting those two together basically in the policy recommendation unofficially off the record that countries should default aggressively? Chatham-Halfrul, I don't know.
Yeah, of course. Whatever you say is obviously in my opinion of the OECD's development centers of things. No, I think here the issue is the following. I mean, what you want to do is probably is to find it. And it also has to do a lot with the intertemporal aspect, you know. For example, and so I'm half Uruguayan, half German, so half the default, half the but if you compare, for example, there was a big debate in the South Korean in general, like between comparing the Argentinian and the Uruguayan default. Actually, Uruguay would always say it was not a default, but of course it was a restructuring that inflicted some losses on bondholders, so it is technically a default, of course. Because of this particular issue, of course, if the haircut is really big, etc., and in a certain sense, Argentina still, if we see obviously now there's a lot of problems in Argentina, but if they're still sort of keeping afloat, it has to do that still a lot of the payments are down the road, you know, the bonds they restructure have so much, so the implicit interest rate is just hilarious, so debt servicing is actually very low, etc. So you could argue, you know, in a certain sense, it gives you obviously mechanically more room to breathe if you just, you know, restructure big way in a certain sense. Otherwise, but the issue here is, for example, Uruguayans did not show they had a market-friendly restructuring, and they gained access to almost immediately to markets, and I think the proof is also now, we'll have to see, for example, now what's going to happen if in February, I don't know, what's going to happen to the Argentinian bonds, for example, but I think it's still an issue, and what we've seen, for example, in Argentina, in terms of policy adjustment right now is because they don't have access to markets. So you have to close the balance of payments and then do all sort of a little bit more crazy things that are probably not so good for growth and for market balance.
Can I just say
this? Sure, but
John,
the interesting thing is that if you ask in Europe, the political leader, which is the majority of the people in Argentina, in both countries they believe that they have done what the right thing.
No,
they completely opposite.
Okay.
Can I just say something
a little
bit?
Yeah, we can have
a
last word.
Right. I think it's a little bit different if you think about it from the perspective of the country and if you think about it systemically. Because even though I criticize the banks a lot, I don't want German banks and French banks and British banks to go bankrupt. I wouldn't really care so much about the bankers, but because of the damage it would do to the economy. And so, for example, I think from a purely Greek perspective, I would say they should default, although they still don't have a primary surplus, so they would actually be worse off if they default. But supposing it's sometimes better from a debtor perspective to default if it doesn't threaten the banks. And I think it's very complicated in the European case because the banks are also in the region,
At least in Latin America, even though in the 80s, Latin American countries did service the dead and sacrifice their wealth, perhaps they didn't have to do that to save the American and the British bank. But in a way, in a European context, I think it's important that the banks don't go bankrupt. And one thing that was very interesting in the Latin American case was that debt relief, the Brady Plan, was only granted when there were enough provisions in the bank. And actually, I haven't seen a study of how strong, say, the German and French banks would be if some countries did default. But I suspect, you know, with all the contagion and all the kind of interconnectedness, that it would be a very risky exercise. So I think you have to kind of separate the narrow country interests of a small country, say, like Uruguay, with say, what would happen if Spain gave itself a hand.
Great, thanks. I want to give Jose a chance to
Answer
as well, and then we'll have our break.
Very, very short to this, to your comment. I completely agree, and I think what you're saying is exactly a different way of putting the way, putting it, what I say in a different way. That when we had a chance to have a fiscal union in the, we didn't create a fiscal union in the 90s because the policymakers forgot about it or didn't realize that it was because they consciously didn't want it, and Germany didn't want it, right? And there was huge discussions, and the only politically sustainable way of creating a monetary union was a monetary union without a fiscal union. And now we have to decide whether we want to create a fiscal union, and now the debate is whether this fiscal union means some sort of democratic governance of how this fiscal union is going to work, and this recent debate about how we spend 1% of GDP is very bad. Is it a very bad signal about how a fiscal union in Europe would work? Or we create some sort of automatic rules about how the fiscal union is, which I think has the problems that I outlined before. Or we decided that without a fiscal union, a monetary union is not sustainable. So I think that's the trilemma that we have to address now, right?
Which is the non-EMU country of the three which has less fiscal trust? Is it the UK?
No, which has less... I think it's Denmark. No, actually, it's Denmark. It's Denmark, I believe. I can check. UK has increased, actually. It was the
really?
Trust towards the... trust in the EU. I mean, the level in 91 was... In 2001 was very low. So in 2011 was slightly higher. I mean, it's still one of the low... In the low range, but...
Well, please join me in thanking the panelists for three excellent questions.